splendid. I think we're struggling slightly to control the air conditioning, so we're going to have to keep windows open. If you're slightly too cold on that side by the windows, there's some nice warm seats here. And if you're slightly too warm on this side, there's some nice cool seats there. And if you want to something in between, all those seats look like they're taken already. Good. It's great to see everybody. I hope you've had good night's sleep. I hope you've had good breakfast and are feeling wide awake and ready to get started. A couple of words by way of introduction. First of all, working out the acoustics of this room, particularly with the window open, if you can't hear me at the back, say something and I'll try to speak up. I also need to say, for those of you who don't know me, that I've got genuinely terrible eyesight. So if I need to glance at my notes, I'll do something like that. If you wave a finger because you want to say it's too warm, can you open some more windows? Or you can't hear me, I won't see the finger. So you need to just speak up and say, "Oi, Michael, speak up, will you?" Yes, and if I do that with my notes, just be very English and polite and pretend you haven't noticed. Good. Are we all settled? Everybody happy and comfortable? Then let us begin. Let me begin by, you should have a handout on your chair, which gives you roughly the idea of where I'll be going and the main topics I'll be covering. Let me begin by trying to set out what I'm hoping to achieve in the session this morning. Eschatology is the doctrine of the end of the world. It's a very big subject and covers all sorts of things. I'm not going to try to cover lots of it. There's some things which we just don't know very much about in the Bible and which aren't therefore very important, but which some parts of the church get very stressed about. So is there going to be a millennium at the end? Will Jesus come before the millennium or after the millennium? Will there be a rapture of the saints before the end? Will Jesus come to earth or will we rise up in the air to join him? Those details, the Bible actually has little to say about. There's but one verse pointing in each of the different directions, and you can't really deduce much from it. So rather than get very stressed by it the way some churches do, I think I'm just going to ignore it. It's not a big deal. What I am going to talk about is the fact that Jesus said he will return and bring about the end of the world, final judgment, and a new creation. And that's what I'm going to focus on. There's very, very, very much more in the Bible about that. It is very much more important and is very much more exciting. And even within that, I'm going to focus more on the positive, the new creation that Jesus is going to bring in. It's not because the judgment isn't important. It's extremely important. But we talk quite a lot about that from the pulpit at St. Helens. So I'm going to focus more on the new creation side of it in all my talks today, really. You've all been at St. Helens for a while. In the overview, I suspect most of you have been here for about 3 years. You know that the end towards which God is working, the final judgment, Jesus' return, the new creation, is something we stress quite a lot at St. Helens. We mention it very often in our preaching. We have something like a Bible overview, which tells the story of how God gets from the fall at the beginning to the new creation at the end. So you know the new creation is important and that Jesus' return is important. Actually, let me just pause this. Somebody raised this point with me. I'm going to use the word Bible story or something like it quite often over the course of the weekend. It's because I can't think of a better word for it. Obviously, it's not fiction. It's not made up story. It's the account of what God is doing. It's the narrative of what he's doing. It's the plot of what he's doing. And I'll use those words interchangeably. The trouble is, for most of us, we tend to think of all of those as really talking about something which is fiction. It isn't. It's the real deal. So if I use the word story, it's not fiction story. It's real deal story account. So hopefully that clarifies that. But let me come back to the main point I was making, which is we all know that the end of the world, Jesus' return, the new creation, is important. I want us to understand why we stress it so much at St. Helens. Why is this end that we think God is working towards such a big thing that we want to make such a big deal of it? I want us to see not just that it is a big idea, that we're right to stress it the way we do at St. Helens, but it is one of the, I would say, probably three, maybe four most important ideas in the whole Bible. It is not a minor thing, but a really major, major thing. A gospel that doesn't have the new creation at its heart is not just a slightly different gospel, a gospel with a slightly different emphasis. It is seriously wrong. It is a false gospel. Let me say that again, because I think it is quite harsh, but I'll say it again. A gospel that doesn't have the new creation at its center is a false gospel. The difference between what we teach in this area and what many other parts of the church teach is not just us being idiosyncratic. It is as crucial as our emphasis on Jesus dying on the cross and rising again to bring us salvation. We know that that's a truth worth fighting for. We know we wouldn't go to a church that didn't stress Jesus' death on the cross as an atonement for sin and the resurrection. I want us to see that we should have the same attitude to the new creation and Jesus' return, that a church that doesn't really make a big deal of that and doesn't make that central is a church that we really should, I hope by the end of the weekend, would have grave reservations about going to. I will say a little bit more in the next session about how we treat people who differ, because obviously they do. It's different from the resurrection, from Jesus' death on the cross, in that that is a doctrine we have talked about and contended for many years, and therefore churches that differ on that, we would deal differently than the new creation, which is not something we've talked about. But what I'm hoping to do in this first session is help us to see that the new creation is that big a deal. It is a deal as important as Jesus' death on the cross. That's quite a strong statement I've made there, and I suspect some of you are already twitching slightly and feeling slightly uncomfortable and thinking, is that right? I want to try to convince you over the course of today that it is right, it is what the Bible teaches, but I do not want you just to take my word for it. As I said last night, the two reactions which I think would be very sad are either if you just reject what I've said out of hand or accept what I've said out of hand. I hope that what you'll do is go to the Bible and examine it for yourself to see if these things be so. If I'm wrong, come and correct me so that I can change what I say. And if the Bible does teach it, then engage with it and think about it. That's the hope and the goal and the prayer for the weekend. But I want to do even more than simply say Jesus' return and the new creation is one of the most important truths in the whole Bible. I want us to see that it is an incredibly exciting truth as well. It's not just important, it is extremely exciting. Something we should love, something we should long for, is Jesus' return. Most of us will know, or most of us will have hoped for at some point or other, Jesus' return just before something terrible. Most people who have been students, the night before the exams they haven't done any revision for, hope that Jesus will return before the exams. What I'm hoping to achieve is that by the end of this weekend, you will long for Jesus' return even before the most exciting thing, because it is even more exciting. So Phil Martin and Anna Forbes are getting married this afternoon. I hope that they'd be so excited by the new creation and Jesus' return that if they thought that Jesus, or they knew that Jesus was returning between now and 2 o'clock when they're getting married, instead of saying, no, Jesus, please wait 24 hours till we get married, they'd say, yes, do come. Matt Evans and Caroline Lever are getting married next Saturday. I hope they'd say the same thing, that at the end of this, they'd think, yep, even though marriage is something we're so looking forward to, it is such an exciting thing, we'd much rather Jesus came first because it is such a big deal. So that, again, is one of my goals for this weekend, is to achieve that. And finally, I want us to see that the new creation is so important that we should build our entire lives around it. Not because we ought to, not because there's some sense of obligation and duty, but because it is such an incredibly wonderful truth, such a thrilling and exciting truth, that we would want to do it, we would long to do it. It will therefore totally reshape our understanding of the gospel, of Christianity, our lives, and this world. I'll say more about how those practical implications work out in the second session this morning. But that sort of set the bar for what I'm hoping to achieve both in this session and the rest of the weekend quite high. We've now got this very high target of what I'm trying to achieve, one of the most important doctrines in the whole Bible. Something which is so exciting we should long for it. Something so radical it should utterly transform us. That's the hope for this weekend. So that's the thing to work towards. That's the thing to pray towards. That's the thing to talk about with one another. Let me begin first, though, with how the Bible shows that the new creation is key. We can begin to see how important an idea it is in the Bible when we see how much airtime it gets in the New Testament. All except the three smallest books of the New Testament mention Jesus' return, or the new creation, or the final judgment. So the three shortest books are 2 John, 3 John, and Philemon, 2 John and 3 John in that order. And they're all about half a page long each. And those don't mention it, but every other book in the New Testament does. There are 260 chapters in the New Testament altogether. And there are 318 references to Jesus' return, or the final judgment, or the new creation. So it gets mentioned on average more than once per chapter in the entire New Testament. It gets mentioned about once in every 13 verses in the New Testament. It gets a lot of airtime in the New Testament. But it's not just the number of times it gets mentioned. It's the fact that when it gets mentioned in very striking, strong terms, which really should make us sit up and take note. Let's have a look at some of those, just to see just what the Bible has to say about this topic. Now, partly because my eyesight is so bad, and partly so you have a change of voice, Jessie Dare, I think, is that right? Yep. Is going to be doing the reading of the verses for me. Look some of these up. Look these up, please, because I think they are really very important. The references are on your sheet, but I'll read them out, and you can look them up, and Jessie will read them to us. Let's begin with John 18:36.
Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from the world."
Thank you. So see what Jesus is saying there. His kingdom is not of this world. To the extent that he's prepared to die, his servants are not going to fight. It's not a big deal what happens to him now. His kingdom is elsewhere. Second passage to look at is Mark 8:34-38.
And he called to him the crowd with his disciples and said to them, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his life? For what can a man give in return for his life? For whoever is ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him will the Son of Man also be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels."
Thank you. Most of us have done Mark's Gospel. We'll remember that passage. One of the most striking passages, wasn't it, in Mark? What Jesus says there is that if you want to be his disciple, you have to take up your cross. You have to die to this world. Because what does it profit to gain this whole world but lose your life in eternity? Which again just shows how important and how much bigger the new creation and eternal life is than everything in this world. Again, very strong statement. The passage I think you're looking at this Thursday is Hebrews 11. Let's have a look at a couple of verses from it. Jessie, can you read Hebrews 11, verse 1, first of all? And then verse 13 to 16 after that. Hebrews 11, verse 1, and then verses 13 to 16.
"Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." And then verses 13 to 16.
Yes, please.
"Okay. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For people who speak thus make it clear that they're seeking a homeland. If they'd been thinking of that land from which they had gone out, they would have had an opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared for them a city.
Thank you. So just look at those again. Hebrews 11:1 defines faith as the assurance of things not yet, the conviction of things not yet. It's a looking forward. It's a crucial part of faith. The rest of Hebrews 11 is then an account of some of the great heroes of faith in the Old Testament. And in the middle, you get this pause at verses 13 to 16 just to talk about what faith meant for them, which is not looking to the things in this world, acknowledging there were strangers and exiles in this world, looking forward to a better country, the new creation. That is what faith looked like for the great heroes like Abraham in the Old Testament. So that's what faith should look like for us as well. So again, can you see how this new creation that God is preparing for us isn't just an incidental aside? It is the part, it's the key thing that faith is about, is looking forward to it, longing for it, waiting for it, acknowledging it's not about here. Let's have a look at Romans 8. Again, many of you will have looked at that last year. Jesse, Romans 8, please, verses 18 to 25.
For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. For in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience.
Thank you. Again, a very strong passage. The new creation is so wonderful that the whole of creation is longing for it. Not just us. The whole of creation is longing for this new creation to come about. It is so much better that all the sufferings, all the hardships of this world pale into insignificance in comparison with this new creation, is what that verse says, that passage says. Again, 2 Peter. We're going through a lot of the different authors. So it's not even just one of the authors in the New Testament, you'll notice. Across the whole range, they're making this point very strongly. So 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 10 to 13. Jesse, again, please.
2 Peter's after Hebrews.
Yes.
But the day of the Lord will come like a thief, and then the heavens will pass away with a roar, and the heavenly bodies will be burned up and dissolved, and the earth and the works that are done on it will be exposed. Since all these things are thus to be dissolved, what sort of people ought you to be in living lives of holiness and godliness, waiting for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be set on fire and dissolved, and the heavenly bodies will melt as they burn? But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells.
Thank you. So again, this new creation, when it comes, is so tremendous that it should utterly govern our lives now. What sort of lives of righteousness should we live now in the light of what it's going to be like then? The whole of this world will be dissolved, pass away, some of the original texts, in the light of this new creation which is coming. And we'll see later on that Revelation 21 explicitly says this creation will pass away. The new creation will replace it. Again, very strong statement. The next passage is particularly long and particularly dense, but very important. So do look this one up in particular. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16 to 5, verse 10. As I said, it's quite a dense passage. So, Jesse, if you could read it particularly slowly, or with a couple of pauses at least in the middle, maybe, to digest, would be really helpful. But it's a very important passage.
So we do not lose heart, though our outer nature is wasting away, our inner nature is being renewed day by day. For this slight momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. For we know that if the tent, which is our earthly home, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us his Spirit as a guarantee. So we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil.
Thank you. So look at that passage. Affliction in this body, but incredible glory awaiting us in the future, which means that we long to put off this mortal body, this tent that we dwell in now, as we look forward to the eternal, permanent home that God has prepared for us, which totally transcends any affliction, any suffering, any hardship now. So again, a very strong statement of just a comparison. We long to be away from this body, to be in the new creation, says Paul. That's how big a deal it is. It's not just there. It's something which we long for and wait for and really puts everything in this world into perspective by comparison. Look again at 1 Corinthians, back one book, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 19.
If in this life only we have hoped in Christ, we are of all people most to be pitied.
Thank you. Again, an incredibly strong statement, isn't it? If there's no new creation, if for this life only we have believed, we are of all people most to be pitied. If there's no new creation, give up being a Christian is really not worth it. But of course, that isn't the case. There is a new creation. And the final verse to look up is Philippians chapter 1, verse 21.
For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Thank you. Again, such a strong statement from Paul. If I live in this world, there's only one purpose, Christ. But actually, dying is better. I'd rather die because that's preferable. That's gain. That's what Paul thought. Can you see just how strong these verses are? They're just a sample as well. There are a lot more verses which make the same point, but I thought that was probably enough just to give us a feel for not just how much the Bible says about it, but just in what strong language, what stark terms it talks about just how much more wonderful the new creation is than this world. Whatever your life is like, whether it's full of affliction and trouble now, never mind, the new one will more than make up. Is your life now full of joy and triumph and everything is going well? The new one is so much better that everything good now will pale into insignificance. The new creation is just incredibly wonderful, says the New Testament. So I hope we see there that the New Testament shows very clearly just how important Jesus' return and the new creation are. It's vital that it's the New Testament that focuses on this idea. This is a slight digression, but I think important for us as we think about how to read the Bible in something like a Bible overview. Earlier in the Bible, there are other ideas that are also quite big and get a lot of airtime, but they aren't necessarily important because the story has moved on. So if you go to the first five books of the Bible, for example, there's an awful lot about animal sacrifice. Those of you who have tried to read Leviticus have probably given up after about 10 chapters just because you've got really tired about the different ways you should sacrifice goats and lambs and calves and turtle doves and the different circumstances under which you should sacrifice them. But we don't bother with any of that these days because the story has moved on from there. So animal sacrifice has got a lot of airtime, but it was pointing us to something much bigger, Jesus, which has come. And so we've left the animal sacrifices behind. I think you saw just last Thursday, didn't you? 2 days ago. The blood of bulls and goats I do not desire, says the writer to the Hebrews. Well, the writer to the Hebrews quoting one of the Psalms. It's all pointing to Jesus. We've left that behind. But when you get to the new creation, the New Testament, it's not something we've left behind. This is the age we live in now. The fact the New Testament makes such a big deal of it means it is still such a big deal for us now. As you read the Bible story, you need to think, where am I in the story, in order to work out how big a deal some of the things are. The general principle is, if something turns up big in the New Testament, it is big for us now, because we're in the same period in history. If it turns up big earlier in the story, the Old Testament, particularly the first bit of the Old Testament, you need to think twice. Some of it, like animal sacrifices, like building the tabernacle in the desert, we've moved on beyond that. We don't need, it's there, it's educative, but it's not that big a deal for us, even though chapters of the Old Testament are spent on how you build the tabernacle. But some parts there, like description of the character of God, remain big, because the character of God doesn't change. So if you're early in the story, you need to think hard. If you're late in the story, you can assume if it's big, then it's big for us. That is a general principle for how to read the Bible. And all of that, sort of thinking about how the Bible story as a whole works, leads me on to my next big reason for saying that the new creation really, really is a big deal in the Bible. And that's how the whole Bible story makes the new creation a big deal. The whole Bible story shows that Jesus' return and the new creation is one of the three or four most important ideas in the Bible. Let me give you four pieces of evidence for that. First, the Bible's overall account, the big narrative, the plot, shows that the new creation is key. The Bible starts with God creating a wonderful world, Genesis 1 and 2, and humankind, Adam and Eve, wrecking it, Genesis 3. You all saw that back in October last year. The entire Bible, then, from Genesis 4 right to the end, is about God putting right what we ruined by means of a salvation plan that he gradually reveals more and more fully. Sometimes he reveals more fully by adding more details to the story, and so we see more and more about what he's doing. Sometimes he reveals what he's doing by doing something which he says, well, that could have been it, but it wasn't. We'll look at why he does that a bit more later. But animal sacrifices, again, a great example. Will an animal sacrifice be enough to take away sin? No, it won't. We need the sacrifice of a perfect human being, God's own son, Jesus. So the animal sacrifices were, if you like, to show us what didn't work before we got to what did work. But the story basically moves us on towards the end. And the end is the new creation, where everything that we wrecked at the beginning is put right. So the new creation is the goal of all that God is doing. That is what he's about. It's the climax of the story. It's the place where the problem of the fall is finally and fully dealt with. It is the key that helps us understand everything else that God is saying and doing in the Bible, is to see where the whole thing is driving towards. The whole Bible plot shows that Jesus' return and the new creation is an incredibly important idea. The only other ideas I think that are as important as the goal of everything God is doing is God's own person and character. There is only one God, and this is what he's like, a creator God, a powerful God, a sovereign God, a loving God, a merciful God, a faithful God. That is as important idea. And the third great idea in the triumvirate, I think, is Jesus, his son, who came to be the only sacrifice that could actually achieve rescue, who will be for all eternity our King and Lord and Bridegroom. There are a couple of other ideas which are also very big and are contenders, but I don't think are quite as big. One is our nature as sinful, fallible human beings who are really incapable of doing any of this on our own, and the church, God's people, who he's rescuing. So those, if you like, are the sorts of really big ideas dominating the Bible, and the new creation is right up there with the rest of them. The next three pieces of evidence I want to give us unpack this idea by showing that many of the other great Bible themes also show that the new creation is key. So we will know by this stage in the overview that one of the most important themes in the Bible is that of God making promises and then fulfilling them. The Bible is full of God making promises and then fulfilling them, isn't it? But the promise above all, the most important, the governing promise, if you like, of the whole Bible, is made in Genesis 12 when God calls Abraham and makes the promise to him that he will be Abraham's God and Abraham and his descendants will be God's people, that they will get a land, that they'll be blessed, that they'll be a blessing. And that promise, by this stage we have seen in the overview, evolves and evolves and develops and is a promise of the new creation. So that huge promise theme and fulfillment theme finds its climax in the promise of the new creation. In embryonic form in Genesis 12, becoming clearer and clearer, the land is not Canaan, it is a new creation. The blessing is not just lots of crops and prosperity in this world. It is all the blessings of the new creation. Another of the Bible's greatest themes is the theme of God rescuing his people. We all know that the gospel is about God, about Jesus rescuing us. The Bible is full of rescues, but all the rescues in the Bible are there to help us understand Jesus' great rescue of us. And as the Bible unfolds, we see that the key to rescue is what we are rescued for. If you don't get a rescue for something, the rescue fizzles and turns into nothing. So the great example of that is the flood. The flood is one of the greatest rescues in the Bible. The whole world is covered with water. One man and his family alone are rescued. But there isn't any rescue for. They're rescued from being drowned, but God makes no promise about what happens the other side. They're basically put back into the world, just washed clean. And within the chapter, sin and death and all the sins are back again. Nothing has changed. A rescue from something is only half a rescue. And the Bible from then on moves quite quickly onto, you need to know what you're rescued for. That is crucial to the rescue. So when Israel is rescued from Egypt, she's not just rescued from Egypt to languish forever in the desert. That would be miserable. And Israel, as you know, says, this would be miserable, we don't like this. No, Israel is rescued from Egypt in order to get into the promised land of Canaan. And God shows, as the Bible goes on, that what you're rescued for is absolutely essential as part of rescue. And rescue is one of the greatest themes. Jesus' rescue for us, the Bible is clear, is for the new creation. So we very often teach Jesus' rescue of us as rescue from God's wrath and judgment, rescue from our sin. And that is absolutely right and absolutely crucial. But it is half the rescue story. The other half of the rescue story is what we are rescued for, which is the new creation. And without that, the rescue story is not complete. So the idea of Jesus' rescue for us also makes the new creation key, because that rescue for is such a big part of it. A third great Bible theme, which again makes the same point, is the great Bible theme of God's anointed king. Again, the Bible overview, I hope, has helped us understand just how important the idea of king is in God's story. Israel wanted a king. God gave them a king. But it's the line of David that he'd really elected and chosen, to whom he makes the third of the great covenants, that David's son will be his king forever, to bring blessing and fulfillment of the promise. And the king idea is then huge from David onwards, right through the Bible. And that king is, of course, Jesus. But where is Jesus king? He's not king in this world. As he said in that John 18 passage we read, my kingdom is not of this world. His kingdom is in the new creation. Only in the new creation will he actually rule visibly, gloriously, acknowledged by all his people. Only at the very end Will he achieve everything he came to do? Will he come into his kingship? Jesse, can you read Ephesians 1 verse 10 for us, please?
As a plan for the fullness of time, to unite all things in him, things in heaven and things on earth.
Thank you. The hymn there is, of course, Jesus. So God's plan is a plan for the fullness of time. It's for the end. Only then will everything be united in and under Jesus. Will God's plan have reached its culmination? Will Jesus be the king he's meant to be? The Gospels, you will know from many, many stories. William is preaching on them at the present moment on Tuesdays. And I think, is it Sunday mornings he started preaching on Luke? Yeah. The Gospels are full of stories of Jesus departing to receive a kingdom. And then he comes back again to take his people. So the kingdom isn't in this world. The kingdom is in the new creation. If we want to understand Jesus as king, we've got to understand the new creation, because that is where his kingdom is. Jesus, God's purpose for his beloved son is only fulfilled in the new creation. The theme of God's king points to the new creation as key. I could go on. You could take almost any theme in the Bible and you'll see exactly the same thing. The new creation, for example, is the place where God himself is glorified. So God being glorified, big Bible theme. Is God glorified here on earth? No. We all, well, virtually all of us, work out in the secular world. We've got non-Christian friends and family and neighbors. Do any of them glorify God? No, they don't. It's only in the new creation that God will be glorified as he's meant to be glorified. We know that sin is a huge problem in the Bible. Jesus came to die to rescue us from sin. We hate the sin in our own lives, I hope. Where will sin actually finally disappear and we will be completely triumphant over it? In the new creation. So can you see how virtually every theme you take of any significance finds its climax and its fulfillment and its end point in the new creation? And the point I'm making that is, if we do a thematic study of the Bible, virtually every single one of the Bible's great themes points to the new creation as the goal of that theme. So, in conclusion of this point, the New Testament, the overall shape of the Bible, the themes of the Bible, they all say the new creation is one of the biggest ideas in the Bible, one of the three or so biggest ideas in the Bible. And I hope that all of this is enough to show just how important the new creation is. It is the goal. It is the climax of everything God is doing. It is the thing towards which everything is heading. It's the place where God's purposes are fulfilled. His purposes for himself, for his son, for us, for his creation. They all get fulfilled in the new creation and only in the new creation. What matters, therefore, is not this world, but the new creation. That is what Christianity is about. That's what the gospel is about. In fact, in the New Testament, there is very little on the blessings that we as Christians should expect in this world. Now, that might be a bit of a shock to some of us, but there's very little in the New Testament about the blessings that we as Christians should expect in this world. And there's nothing in the New Testament about changing this world to make it a better place. You know, social reform, improving the world, transforming it. There's nothing there. It's all about pointing forward to the new creation where God will do it. Everything that we long for in the world, whenever you look at the world and you think this is such a rotted up world, if only there was more justice, more equality, more fairness, less rapacious greed, whatever you think the problems of the world are, there's nothing in the New Testament about us solving it now. It's all about God will solve it in the new creation. So it's really important it's solved. But the place it's solved is the new creation. And that's why the new creation is so important. The New Testament has very little to say about this world, at least in terms of as a goal. There's quite a lot about how we live in it in the light of the new creation, but not much about it as a goal. A lot about the new creation as the goal. It will affect our lives profoundly now, as we'll see in the next session after the coffee break. But it's affecting it because it is there in the future waiting for us. What I want us to do now, just for about 5 minutes or so, in groups of twos and threes, is just think about what I've just been saying, what do you feel about the new creation? In the light of what I've said, are you thrilled by it? Are you still slightly disinterested in it? Are you hoping for it? Are you hoping it doesn't come too soon because things you're looking forward to, like a marriage or something really exciting are on the horizon, a holiday, something you're looking forward to, a new career? Are you angry with God because he seems to be more concerned with a new creation than this one? How do you feel honestly about this idea of new creation? Just spend 2 or 3 minutes in groups just chatting about how you feel about it. Good. I'm glad you had enjoyed chatting about that. Hopefully you'll get more chances to chat about it in a moment as well. I won't take feedback from you, but my suspicion is that most of us, if we're really honest, aren't as excited by the new creation as all of that. When we hear about it in a talk, a sermon, a study, then we think, yeah, this is great, possibly. Some of us may not even do that. But come Monday morning at work, it's out of our mind. It's not the sort of thing we daydream about. You may daydream about the new house you're going to buy, the new car you're going to get, married life, the new career. There are all sorts of things we daydream about, but I suspect for most of us, the new creation is not one of them. If we think about it at all, we think it's slightly dull. It's not a place with much purpose. Whilst this world, by contrast, is really interesting. It's full of lovely things and lovely people. It's things full of things we want to do. In other words, our attitude to the new creation and God's are really quite different. For us, it's a slightly boring, slightly dull, I'm not really sure I'm that excited sort of place. For God, it's the goal of everything he's doing. It's the reason he sent his son to die is to rescue people for it. When what we want and what we love and what God wants and what God loves are different, there's a problem and we need to change. It's not God who's going to change, it's us. And we need to think about why our attitude to it is so different to God's. And the reason, I think, is because we just don't understand what the new creation will be like. We tend to think of the new creation as the cartoonists portray it. We float around on clouds playing harps, and that looks seriously dull. Even if you're a musician and the harp is your instrument, the thought of playing it for all eternity on a cloud, I suspect, doesn't appeal that much. But that is not the Bible's picture of the new creation. It is not remotely the Bible's picture of the new creation. We have been deceived by the secular world, and we have bought into that deception without challenging it at all. We need to look at what the new creation is like and just see how different it is to the way the cartoonists portray it. And we need to adopt the Bible's view of it, because that is what will transform our attitude to the new creation. So my goal for the next 15 minutes is to help us think about what the Bible says about what the new creation will be like, so we get as excited by it as God is. Charlie has begun to talk about this a bit in 1 Corinthians 15 on Sunday evenings for those of us who are at the 6 p.m. service. But I will recap some of that and then try to go beyond where Charlie got to. So as Charlie said, it's a new creation. It's a creation, like this one is a creation, but it's a better one. Remember, God made this creation, and he made it knowing from the beginning that it wasn't where the end point of his plan was. The end point of his plan was always going to be a new creation. This creation is the dry run. This creation is the architect's model. Have you ever had a look at an architect's model? You know, built out of cardboard. Not that much detail in it. Compare, tiny little thing. Compare that with a real building when it comes. Much bigger, much grander. This world is the architect's model. Build out of cardboard, plaster of Paris. The new creation is the real thing. If this creation is full of wonderful things, that is full of far more wonderful things. If this creation is incredibly diverse and has all sorts of interest in it and texture in it and color in it and vibrancy in it, the new creation will have more. It is a much more wonderful thing. And the Bible talks about it as having cities and countrysides, animals and food and drinks and party. And that's just to give us a glimpse. Let's have a look at just a few passages to begin to give us a feel for that. Let's focus primarily on Isaiah to start with. Jesse, can you read Isaiah 25, verses 6 to 8, please? Isaiah is about in the middle of the Bible, as most of us will know. Quite a big book in the middle. If you've got to the Psalms, jump forward a couple of books.
On this mountain, the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, of rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well-refined. And he will swallow up on this mountain the covering that is cast over all peoples, the veil that is spread over all nations. He will swallow up death forever. And the Lord God will wipe away tears from all faces, and the reproach of his people he will take away from all the earth, for the Lord has spoken.
Thank you. So look, just look at even those three verses say about it. Death is no more. Sorrow is no more. The veil that shrouds everything and makes everything sad and depressed, taken away. Instead, party time. Great food, wonderful meat, well-aged wine. Not just party, but sort of really top quality, classy party we're talking about. Queen's Diamond Jubilee party has nothing compared to it. It's not just a street party. It's even her own party will pale into comparison compared with what we're going to get in the new creation by way of party time. Can you read Isaiah chapter 60, please, Jesse, verses 17 to 22?
Instead of bronze, I will bring gold. And instead of iron, I will bring silver. Instead of wood, bronze. Instead of stones, iron. I will make your overseers peace and your taskmasters righteousness. Violence shall no more be heard in your land. Devastation or destruction within your borders. You shall call your walls salvation and your gates praise. The sun shall be no more your light by day, nor for brightness shall the moon give you light, but the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your God will be your glory. Your sun shall no more go down, nor your moon withdraw itself, for the Lord will be your everlasting light, and your days of mourning shall be ended. Your people shall all be righteous. They shall possess the land forever. The branch of my planting, the work of my hands, that I might be glorified. The least one shall become a clan, and the smallest one a mighty nation. I am the Lord. In its time, I will hasten it.
Thank you. So again, just a quick picture of how much better the new creation is. As I said a second ago, the smells will be better, the tastes will be better, the colors will be better. And the way Isaiah is portraying it is, take all the things that you make of this world. Instead of bronze, you'll have gold. Instead of iron, silver. Everything will just be that much grander and better and more glorious. Even the sun and the moon won't be necessary. They'll pale into comparison because God himself will be so wonderful. We will walk in the light of God himself. We won't even just need what he made, the sun, to give us light. It is an incredible picture of what a new creation will be like. It's a place of peace. It's a place of blessing where the things that will drive us aren't fear, aren't jealousy, aren't ambition, but peace and righteousness. They will be our overseers and our taskmasters. A completely different motivation, a completely different creation, but the stuff will be there, just better, brighter, more wonderful. Jesse, can you read Isaiah 65, verses 17 to 25, please?
For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things shall not be remembered or come into mind. But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem to be a joy, and her people to be a gladness. I will rejoice in Jerusalem and be glad in my people. No more shall be heard in it the sound of weeping and the cry of distress. No more shall there be in it an infant who lives but a few days, or an old man who does not fill out his days. For the young man shall die 100 years old, and the sinner 100 years old shall be accursed. They shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat their fruit. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For like the days of a tree shall the days of my people be, and my chosen shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain or bear children for calamity, for they shall be the offspring of the blessed of the Lord, and their descendants with them. Before they call, I will answer. While they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall graze together. The lion shall eat straw like the ox, and dust shall be the serpent's food. They shall not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord.
Thank you. So just look at that picture of what the new creation will be like. It's a place where there will be cities, and there'll be vineyards, and there'll be plants, and there'll be animals, and there'll be mountains. What there won't be is animals eating each other. What there won't be is frustration, where you plant a vineyard and you don't get its fruit, but somebody else does. Any of you who've had the frustration of trying to do something and it not working, you know, you work jolly hard on a project at work, and then the boss pulls the plug and says, no, we're not going to run with it. And you think, all that work down the drain. You try to do something at home and it doesn't work. And your best plan DIY project sort of bombs. All that won't be there. You won't have that sense of frustration. Everything will go the way it will. It's just a picture. So it's not saying there'll be death in the new creation. It's saying in a society in which infant mortality would have been a very rampant problem, it will not exist. Even an infant, when it dies, will die at 100. So it's not there saying there will be death. It's saying, look at how there's all the things that might frustrate you and disappoint you and stress you, they're just all removed. It's just a picture of how totally satisfying and fulfilling the new creation will be. It'll be a place where we have bodies too. So all the things that we can do with our bodies, you know, we see and we hear and we smell and we taste and we touch, and we have all the richness of what our bodies can do, we'll have there too, but much more. So have a look at 1 Corinthians 15, verses 42 to 49. Jesse, please.
So it is with the resurrection of the dead. What is sown is perishable, what is raised is imperishable. It is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory. It is sown in weakness, it is raised in power. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. If there is a natural body, there is also a spiritual body. Thus it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. But it is not the spiritual that is first, but the natural, and then the spiritual. The first man was from the earth, a man of dust. The second man is from heaven. As was the man of dust, so also are those who are of the dust. And as is the man of heaven, so also are those who are of heaven. Just as we have borne the image of the man of dust, we shall also bear the image of the man of heaven.
Thank you. So we've borne the image of the man of dust. We're made like Adam at the present moment. Made of dust, we'll end in dust. Now, a body full of weakness, full of dishonor. If any of you have struggled with ill health, with bits of your body that don't work the way they ought to work, if any of you think your body isn't particularly honorable because it's not the shape you want or the size you want or the complexion you want or your hair isn't the right color or it's disappearing, don't worry. We all suffer with things like that. But the whole point is, that is the man of dust whose image we have borne. One day we will bear Jesus' image, the man of heaven. And that will be a body full of glory, full of power, a life-giving spirit, a completely different body, which will be what bodies were meant to be before the fall kicked in and wrecked everything. This world is made by God, and it is a good world. Genesis 1, God made this world, and it was good. But it was a good dry run. It was a good architect's model. The real one, when he comes, will be very, very much better. And not only is this only the architect's model, the dry run, we have ruined this one. We've spoilt it with sin. We have spoilt it ourselves by the things we've done to it. We have wrecked the environment. To a greater or less extent, you don't need to have political views on how much we affect global warming. You just have to look at how much concrete we've poured over it and the things we do and the buildings we make that are ugly. And you sort of think, there won't be any of that in the new creation. It'll be the best things of this world which are there. The cities in the new creation won't be ugly. They'll be glorious. The cities in the new creation won't be dangerous. They'll be full of peace and righteousness. There'll be animals in the new creation, but they won't eat each other or us. there will be peace. The food and the drink there will be unbelievable. And apart from all that, of course, the other thing that ruins this creation is sin. Our sin and other sins. I mean, what is it that makes your life miserable? Is it not the fact that we are sinners and that people around us are sinners? Yes. But there will be no sin in the new creation. We've read this already, but let's read it again because it's so great. Jesse, can you read 2 Peter 3:13, please? Again.
But according to his promise, we are waiting for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells.
Thank you. So we're waiting for the new heavens and the new earth in which righteousness dwells. What a wonderful thought. Not only is the new creation a creation with all the wonders of this one, as a creation, it's full of purpose, just without the hardship and the pain and the frustration that accompanies purpose here. So when God made Adam and Eve in the garden, he didn't make Adam and Eve to lie around and do nothing and get really bored. He gave them a job to do, to work the garden, to rule it rightly, to fill it. He's not putting us into the new creation to float around on harps, feeling bored out of our minds. He's putting us there to work it, to look after it, to achieve things in it and with it. But without the frustration, without the sin, without the pain, without the ugliness, without the hatred that mars this world. So we saw that in Isaiah 65, so I won't look at that again. Just go back to that at some point. If you want to think, is there going to be stuff to do? What's it going to be like? That passage in Isaiah 65, 17 to 25 is a great place to see just how full of joy and purpose and ambition, right ambition fulfilled the new creation will be. But wonderful though all this is, the highlight of the new creation and the eternity God has planned is that we will be with God and Jesus and relate to them perfectly. Jesse, can you read Revelation 21, 1 to 11, please? It's worth looking this up. I know you're going to look at it in 2 weeks' time, so this is a sneak preview. Revelation 21, 1 to 11, please.
Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and death shall be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore, for the former things have passed away. And he who was seated on the throne said, Behold, I am making all things new. Also he said, Write this down, for these words are trustworthy and true. And he said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give from the spring of water of life without payment. The one who conquers will have this heritage, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. But as for the cowardly, the faithless, the detestable, as for the murderers, the sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars, their portion will be in the lake that burns with fire and sulfur, which is the second death. Then came one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues and spoke to me, saying, Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the holy city Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God, its radiance like a most rare jewel, like a jasper, clear as crystal.
Thank you. Can you read also chapter 22, verses 1 to 5, before you sit down?
Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb, through the middle of the street of the city. Also, on either side of the river, the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, yielding its fruit each month. The leaves of the tree were for the healing of the nations. No longer will there be anything accursed, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it. and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. And night will be no more. They will need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever.
Thank you. There's a lot in those passages which you look at in 2 weeks, but just look at for the moment at all the relational language that is there. God will be their God, and God will be our God, and we will be his people. He will wipe away our tears and care for us. We will see him face to face. There'll be no barrier to the relationship. We will be married to Jesus as the bride of Jesus. God is a relating God. He relates within the Trinity. It's innate within his character to relate. He made us to relate to him. And the whole of eternity will be us relating to him with joy when it happens. The things that we most love about relating to people are just a shadow to point us to what it's like to relate to Jesus, to relate to God. So marriage. Marriage is a wonderful thing. Spoilt in the real world by the imperfections of us and the person we're married to and the circumstances around us. But it's just a picture, a pale shadow of the real marriage, which is between us and Jesus. So everything you long for about marriage, everything you'd hoped for in marriage and it wasn't, everything that you've got in marriage but it could be so much better in reality, that is fulfilled in the new creation. That's why the Bible uses the picture of us married to Jesus so much. Family. The Bible describes us as being God's children, him as being our father. Everything that's good about family, everything that family is meant to be when family is functioning as it ought to, is fulfilled. It's a picture of what it ought to be. Friendship. Jesus describes his disciples as his friends. Everything that's most wonderful about a really, really good friend, even that is but the palest shadow of what it will be like to relate to Jesus and God in eternity. The new creation is a wonderful creation. The new creation is a place full of things to do, purpose and meaning. The new creation is a place where we will relate as we are meant to relate. All the things that you might love about this creation, whether it's things, whether it's relationship, whether it's things to do and purpose, all of that is in the new creation very, very, very much better. This is just the dry run, the palest shadow. It's a children's book, but if you want to get some idea of what it's like in the new creation, I don't know anything better than C.S. Lewis's The Narnia series, particularly the last volume, The Last Battle. But if you haven't read the Narnia series, read it. You have a treat in store. If you haven't read it for a while, read it. You have a treat in store. I don't agree with all C.S. Lewis's theology, but that isn't the point. The point is he has managed to, I think, convey an impression of just how wonderful it is to relate to Aslan the lion, a picture of Jesus, to live in Aslan's country, a picture of the new creation, just how wonderful it is. He talks about the place where the colors are brighter, that the smells fresher, that just gives you a feel for what it will be like. So read him, because he's a master of the English language and conveys the picture of just how wonderful it will be really well. In the new creation, we will relate to God perfectly, with all the joy and wonder of that and none of the frustrations of this. It's worth meditating on what the Bible says about the new creation, so that we get as excited by it as God is. I hope that we've begun to at least get a glimpse of why God is so excited by the new creation. That is where everything will be as he meant it to be, where this architect's model is brought about as the real thing, not just the plaster of Paris model, in all its glory and its wonder. And he wants us to get as excited by that as he is, so that we too look forward to it. We too long for it as he is. One of the best ways, I think, to actually get to love this new creation, to understand it more like he is to actually sort of think about it more. So one of the reasons we don't get as excited by it as God does is because we don't actually think about it very much. I've given us some text, but what I'd like us to do now, on our own, preferably, but if you want to do it in twos and threes, you can do that as well. Think of 20 things you are most looking forward to in the new creation. 20 sounds a lot, but actually it's not many at all. If you can do 20 in a rush, Make it 40. Let me give you a tip. As well as looking at what the passages say will be there in the new creation, think about all the bad things that are in this creation that won't be there. So I don't know what it is that frustrates you. Maybe as you walk back home, the streets are full of litter. There will be no litter in the new creation. Just think of that. That's one of your 20. No litter, no graffiti, no broken windows. You won't worry about the gang of you standing on the corner as you walk and think, should I cross the road as I walk home? There will be none of that. There we are. That's three things out of your 20 already. You can just keep going. Just think of these things because it'll get you excited about the new creation. So for 2 or 3 minutes before we break, either on your own or in 2s or 3s, just produce a list of 20 things, more if you can, that you're looking forward to in the new creation.